That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Ah.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and wants to know where Roy Hodgson's knighthood is. I'm Kevin Day and he's Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, I'm a big man, so congratulations on your victory against Man City, although not on the shameful touchline antics of your manager. Shocking, celebrating a goal like that, really.
Well, I think he was so unused to it, it took him by surprise as well as it did ourselves and young Mr. Guardiola.
Yeah. Yes, I've actually written to Pep Guardiola to commiserate with him and to explain what it's like to win at the Amex on a regular basis. It turns out I'm not that big a man, Kieran. I couldn't just congratulate you. Later in the show, we will be hearing from David Webb, an academy coach and scout at many clubs, including Crystal Palace. But first, some news stories, Kieran. And the first news story is that we have a couple of actors in our garden having dinner with Ali. So if you hear loud acclamatory noise, it's coming from the actors. I can't tell you who they are, but they are quite big names. And let me tell you, if you're au fait with both the front and back end of a panto horse, you'd be really impressed by who we've got in our garden. Our first story involves some big hitters, Kieran. Gary Neville, Jamie Carragher, Rio Ferdinand and Gary Lineker are among several ex-players and journalists to launch a petition to create an independent regulator in football. It seems, Kieran, of all the changes being demanded after the Super League, the independent regulator is the one that's sticking to the wall most of all.
Yes, and I believe that this will be one of the topics that's going to be discussed by Tracy Crouch in terms of the fans-led review. But it looks as if these ex-players, in conjunction with many journalists, have decided to move things forwards by setting up a formal petition. And my understanding is it now has just over 140,000 signatories. Mm. So therefore, it has to be debated in Parliament. And that's due to take place on the 14th of June. Clearly, it would add to the credibility of the petition if more fans want to sign it. You know, it ultimately is a personal choice. There is a map of the whole country to which shows the intensity of signatories, and to no great surprise, the highest proportion of fans in any one borough is in Stretford and Urmston.
Right,
which, given Mr. Neville's background and Rio Ferdinand, isn't hugely surprising, but also sort of, you know, there's plenty of major conurbations as well. So, in terms of this issue of the independent regulator, I think it's potentially a step forwards. It's something which we've suggested ourselves historically, but it's not going to cure all of football's problems. Yeah, if people think this is an easy fix and as a result of this, players' wages are going to come down, tickets are going to become cheaper, and you're going to have a more democratic distribution of wealth and trophies in the Premier League and elsewhere, that won't be the case. So it will, however, you know, hopefully give a voice to those people who perhaps do feel somewhat marginalised. And by that, I'm saying the fans. You know, I read yesterday that Partick Thistle's fans, 97% of them have rejected the offer of a season ticket refund because they're fans, and they say, yeah, and we've always said, if you can afford to do it and you want to do it, fantastic. If you can't, your personal circumstances, whatever they may be, or you just don't feel it's right, then, you know, nobody's to criticize. But, you know, Ryanair, EasyJet, you know, the hotel chains, they would give their eye teeth for this level of people saying, no, it's okay, we booked a flight or a hotel, you keep the money because we want you to exist. So you know, that is an indication of the unique nature of football fandom and just how important the game is to people. So I think it's potentially a good idea. In my view, self-regulation has failed, because we have three competing bodies in the EFL, the Premier League, and the FA. The regulator, in theory, we've got Ofwat, we've got Ofgem, we've got Ofcom. Presumably, this will be Ofoot. We'll be able to
in the theatre. We have Offstage.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
we'll be able to have sanctions, and hopefully we will have. More people's views taken into consideration. But, you know, the danger is that the person who gets appointed is part of the old boys network and on the back of lobbying from, significant vested interests, actually everything becomes very much watered down. So, yes, I think this is good potentially, but I would just have a voice of a slight caution. It's not going to be a quick fix, and all of football's issues are not going to go away just because we have a regulator.
I've got two issues, Kieran. The first is that to get an independent regulator, i.e. one that doesn't belong to a football club or hasn't been involved in a football club, which inevitably will lead to problems, then you need somebody from outside the game, and I don't think that's going to help. And also, I don't quite understand what they're meant to regulate, because as soon as the independent regulator says, do you know what, chaps, you're quite right, ticket prices and wages are way too high, we need to bring those down, then the top six clubs will say, well, that's none of your business, you're not here to regulate that. And what you end up with is a glorified ombudsman. And basically, we've already got a football ombudsman that no one knows about.
Yes. Yeah, you're entirely right. And that's part of my reservation. I don't see how a regulator can get involved in terms of individual contracts of employment or sponsorship. But there is the opportunity to ensure that we don't end up with some of the debacles that we have seen over the course of the last 6 to 9 months, where vested interests have taken advantage of COVID to pursue their own interests in terms of trying to have a power grab of the game, both domestically and on a European level. So, if the regulator says, well, the first thing I'm going to do is to say that any club in England or Scotland who chooses to not compete for the top four places in the Premier League, for example, through the UEFA competition, they automatically lose the right to play the game in the country. And I think that would act as a further deterrent. And I do think that the clubs involved are pretty sanguine as to their recent behaviour. And there is certainly no desire for Super League to rear its ugly head again. But it would nice to have that with some form of regulatory stick, as well as the reaction of fans that led to the collapse of recent events.
Mm. Sorry, I was slightly distracted at the end there, Kieran. So I just noticed that one of the actors has brought a guitar with him, which is just wrong behavior. No wine, just a guitar. It's like, really, who brings it?
You can't beat Michael Row the Boat ashore on a Croydon evening.
Yeah, as long as it's not Stairway to Heaven. Now, one of Manchester United's biggest backers has criticized the club for inflicting, and I quote, reputational damage in the wake of the Super League fiasco.
Yes, this is an investing company called Lindsall Train, and it actually owns a quarter of the shares that are traded in the New York market. So it is the biggest single non-Glazer shareholder of the club. Now, remember that the Glazers have the voting rights stitched up because there's two types of shares. The ones which the Glazer owns carry 10 votes each, and Lindsall Train and the other shareholders have only got one vote each. So 27% of the shares, but it actually carries through to a relatively small proportion of votes. But in the wake of Super League, and this investment company also has shares in Celtic and Juve, they've had meetings with all three clubs with a view to just saying, you know, you need to be cautious about how you go forwards because you know, football is a big industry and it does have a big commercial footprint, and you're damaging that. And there is no doubt that the Glazers are a toxic brand. And what we have seen over the course of the last few days is an expansion of the Not a Penny More campaign. I think when we spoke to people from Blackpool some time ago, that was the vehicle through which they tried to get rid of Owen Oyston. People don't know Owen Oyston, former convicted rapist. That ultimately was successful, but it took a hard approach. What Not a Penny More are doing, and I think this to me is sort of good guerrilla tactics. It's non-violent direct action. So you get the interest, you get the sympathy, but you don't get the criticism. In terms of some of the events that have taken in respect of the protests directly at Old Trafford. So what they're now doing is they're saying, well, you know, we've got these big sponsors of Manchester United, the likes of Adidas, Tag, Cola, Cadbury, AON, and their brands are being, you know, all over the Manchester United website. So let's start clicking on them, because Google Ads charges the advertiser, charges and you got to do this clever, because you know there is anti-bot software and there is anti-abuse software. But remember, Manchester United have got over a billion fans worldwide. So the anti-bot software, if 10% of Manchester United fans just go say, right, well, we're going to click on the Adidas website and we're not going to buy a thing, and that's going to cost Adidas a lot of money. And why are we doing this? We're doing this because we are dissatisfied with the response of the Glazer family to our dissatisfaction. And, you know, to a certain extent, this is sort of the democratization of protest. Ultimately, potentially the future of Manchester United is in the hands, or it isn't, because those hands hold the mice of the fan base itself. So this is an intriguing one. I think that the people behind it are quite savvy, the brands are then going to turn around and say, we're a bit cheesed off with this Manchester United. Perhaps you need to up your game.
It's funny how club owners seem to forget that if a club like Man United have got millions of fans all over the world, some of them are going to be quite clever. And possibly as clever as you. But is this unusual? I mean, obviously, this investment company, I imagine, worried more about their share price than the ethics of the situation. But is it unusual for a minority shareholding group to criticise the majority shareholding group like this?
It is, in the sense of going public. I mean, there are communication lines that take place on a regular basis, by, you know, significant minority shareholders. That's all part of the role of the company to keep in touch, communicate, and manage the shareholder base. But I think this went out in sort of the monthly newsletter of Lindsall Train to say, you know, we just like to say that, you know, we're trying to be the good guys here, and we're unhappy with the behaviour of the owners, and it's a shame, because, you know, Manchester United do lots of good things, and we have said that. I think they're giving subsidised travel, I think, to the tune of £200 for everybody that's going to Gdansk. So they do some good stuff, but it will get relatively small attention, because this type of campaign does get does go out on social media and generates a lot of awareness, and people think, well, it's not going to cost me much to do it. Manchester United are going to face an unusual backlash potentially.
What's the name of that Polish town again?
Gdańsk.
Bless you. I forgot to do it on Sunday. You mentioned it on Sunday. You forgot that I was really cross. Talking of subsidised travel, there are two stories coming out of Man City, one of which is brilliant and one of which couldn't be more symptomatic of the modern game, and they both involve fans to an extent, don't they?
Yes. First of all, the good news, Sheikh Mansour has said that those Manchester City fans that are going to Porto for the Champions League final, the travel's on us. You are being bussed in and bussed out. So, it is going to be a short trip. So, but all the same, it's that the prices are not cheap, there is a good relationship between the owners and the fan base. Because there is no doubt that. The Abu Dhabi owners have made a significant difference to what we've seen on the pitch. It doesn't guarantee them winning every single game, but...
the odd meaningless end-of-season game they struggle with.
Exactly.
Especially when a player is shamefully, wrongfully sent off for no reason at all.
I believe the fans got him sent off, according to...
That's the theory.
Yeah. The 8,000 people synchronized tutting at the Amex. that put the pressure on Stuart Atwell, I can assure you.
I should think just the sound of 8,000 cappuccinos being put gently on the floor would be. Obviously, I didn't watch. I switched. I'm such a child. As soon as you equalise, I switched over and then refused to watch. That's why I don't often see Match of the Day, because I won't watch it if Palace have lost, and I won't watch it if Brighton have won. So,
I'm the same. Except in reverse, of course. But that's how it should be done.
Of course it should. But it was absolutely fantastic to see fans back in the ground. It really was. And in fact, as you'll discover in the next question, I was in the pub this afternoon, and I've left the pub to come back and do this, and I'm going back to the pub before the game tonight. But I was there for the under-23 game on Monday, so that was just made such a difference, even 8,000. Yeah. But anyway, enough of you being in Man City in a meaningless game. Carry on.
So that's that's the good news.
To be fair, Kieran, that's quite. I mean, we know he's as Rich Hall once described something. He's richer than gravity, but he's that's still quite a sizable chunk of money they're paying out there. So that's a nice gesture. That's one that deserves credit. As does Man United subsidising their fans' travel as well.
Yeah. Yep. So we always try to be as even-handed as we can.
But
in addition, the capacity of the Etihad is being decreased by around about 1,000. And this is to allow Manchester City to install double height LED screens for adverts. Right. So the front 2 to 3 rows, I think, on three sides of the ground, which is effectively the three sides, which, of course, you'd see from a television gantry perspective.
Yeah.
Those seats are going to disappear, and they're going to be replaced by these double display advertising hoardings, which will be able to do the Izzy Wizzy adverts. The club have said that fans that sit in those seats will be relocated. Even if they move to more expensive seats, there'll be no extra cost to them. So that is a positive. My only concern is that, if perhaps you're of a certain age, going up to the, if you end up in the gods, that can be a bit of a problem. If you've got to go up 3 or 4 flights of stairs. So that could be an issue. So I hope that is taken into consideration. And also, I'm sure this is exactly the same for you, where you sit, Kevin. you know the, you know, the 10 or 15 people that sit around your seat. You've got to know them over a number of years, even if you didn't know them originally, and you've got that relationship, and it's all part of that social interaction that we have at football, that you sort of build up, you know, new relationships and friendships. And I think that potentially could be lost. And that is a non-monetary issue. And I don't want to come across all, you know, too yogurt knitting about it. But it's part of the game.
No, and of course it is. You're absolutely right. I mean, there was always an issue when stadiums became all-seater that fans said, well, I like where I stand. I like the people I stand with. I can't guarantee I like the people I sit with and so on. But there's nothing like the friendship of people around you every fortnight during the winter who you wouldn't dream of seeing at any stage during the summer.
Yes.
somebody a couple of seasons ago said, why don't we get together in the summer? There's a really awkward silence. It's like, no, we'll see you for the first game.
But
you do get to know them. You find out about their kids and their jobs, and it's you kind of look forward to seeing it. Again, it's one of those stories that it just shows you how things are changing and how it's generally the fans that are at the bottom. It's just like we're moving 1,000 of you so we can make more money from advertising. I don't know what Izzy Wizzy is, Kieran, but now you've mentioned it, I want to buy some, which is the power of advertising, isn't it? As I said, I was just recently in the pub, and I think there was some news on this story on one of the TVs in the background. England fans who had tickets for Euro 2020 are about, or just have, had some news from UEFA about this year's tournament, and that includes you, doesn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, what happened was that UEFA wrote to fans some time ago and said, you've got the choice of either rolling your tickets over for a ballot or taking a refund. And it now appears that ballot is taking place because clearly the capacity at Wembley will be significantly curtailed due to COVID. All fans understand that. All fans appreciate that. What grinds our gears is the fact that it now appears that hospitality packages are being offered which guarantee you tickets. And if you want to go and see England's three Wembley group games and the round of 16, which they might be in, which they might not be in, it's going to cost you £7,200.
Holy mother, really?
Indeed, yes. And I think the feeling is, well, hold on, you know, if they're now effectively trying to resell these packages, why are fans being told potentially that they're losing tickets? Is it a switch to the prawn sandwich brigade? And is that where UEFA's priorities lie?
So does this mean that people who bought tickets 2 years ago now pretty much could possibly miss the game, and somebody who bowls up with a new package could actually pay that money and get a ticket?
That appears to be the case, which is just intuitively wrong, we've slagged off FIFA historically. We gave absolute pelters to the Super League gang, and UEFA sort of by exception sort of became the good guys in football. But what have they done? Were they given us this monstrosity of the Swiss model for the Champions League? And the focus is on he who pays the piper, really. In terms of just trying to get as much money in as they can.
I wish they'd start calling it Euro 2021 as well. It's really confusing. Also, I'd like to hear from how many Scottish listeners about this, because my instinct is the Scottish football authorities wouldn't try and do that, and B, there'd be a lot more protest in Scotland about it if they did. So that's something we'll keep an eye on. And we've mentioned in the past, Kieran, that every now and again Guy will pick a random team and just throw it into the mix for no apparent reason. And this week's random team is Billericay Town, who apparently have made a profit of £1.1 million in 2019-20. But then there's a dot, 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 which is sometimes Guy's clever way of saying there may be more to this story than meets the eye.
Yeah, well, I'm quite happy to talk about Billericay because
you are. I know you are. I've got a pub to get back to.
Mainly because I was a big fan of Ian Jury, and it reminds me of Billericay Dickey.
Fair enough. You can get rid of that now, by the way, apparently.
Penicillin, is it?
Yeah, it used to be yogurt. I guarantee Martin Sir will mention that in his review of this pod.
So for people not familiar with Billericay Town, they were acquired, I think it was in about 2016, by a gentleman called Glenn Tamplin, who was successful in his own line of business, decided to buy a football club, and he signed Paul Konchesky, Jamie O'Hara and Jermaine Pennant.
Yeah.
Footballers, I think it's fair to say, were not necessarily at the peak of their careers at the stage they were bought, and also had by that stage most of the time the references to them tended to be on the front pages of newspapers rather than the back, for various nocturnal related activities, and that didn't work. Billericay Town lost a lot of money on the back of that. And then Glenn Tamplin, I think he made himself manager and then sacked himself. You know, it's one of these fantastic tales which, it deserves its own documentary.
Yeah.
And then he sold the club, which was a cause for concern. And he went out and he bought Romford Football Club. And on day one, he sacked the manager, appointed himself manager again, and signed 15 players. So, you know, it's perfect lunacy. You know, if you think that Apple have got their crazy football program, well, this is nothing on this.
Yeah.
But Billericay Town published their accounts, and it looked as if they'd actually made £1 million in profit. And I was going, blimey, O'Reilly, you know, perhaps I've been harsh on them. And then I thought, well, it's time to check the small print. And it turns out, and fair play to him, that Glenn Tamplin actually wrote off £1.8 million of loans when he left the club to actually leave it in a slightly better financial situation. So you know, give him credit for that. He's always been very entertaining. Sadly, he's not been tweeting recently. Which is a shame because it was never dull following this account.
This final story, Kieran, I have a soft spot for Hibs. I'm happy to admit that. No one should ever support more than one team, but I do have a soft spot for Hibs. So this story is really, really annoying.
Hibernian, and I'm quite keen on Hibs because the Baroness is from Edinburgh.
Uh-huh.
Much to my chagrin, yesterday before the match, she advised me that she'd just quit her job because, in her words, I've had enough of effing Microsoft Teams.
She chose to tell you that just before kickoff. If she'd waited till the final whistle, you wouldn't have given the flying monkey.
Absolutely. Yes,
fine,
yes.
Leave the job. That's fine. Okay.
But they've signed a strategic partnership with the side that beat Manchester City in a meaningless match at the Amex, according to some.
I've never known you so full of yourself. You really are bullish today, aren't you?
It's 1989 since we last beat City in the league, so I've waited a long time.
That's true. Fair point, yes.
And I think this type of thing could take place on a more regular basis going forward. Certainly there have been some issues in terms of Scottish football in respect of potentially allowing Rangers and Celtic to put their Colts team into the fifth or sixth tier, and that has provoked a reaction, some positive, some negative. But the potential benefits of something of this nature would be to allow clubs to have closer communication, to have consistency in terms of player development, pathways. So we'll have to see whether it's successful or not. It's certainly not on the scale of what we see at the City Football Group, in the sense that, you know, that they don't have a shared ownership. But it does look as if they're going to share ideas, and you know, I'm all in favour of communication, because you know, that's what you do as a teacher, and you know, you find out what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, it seems a strange juxtaposition of clubs, I have to say. And at the risk of alienating those Scottish listeners that we love so much, would you expect the club from the English Premier League to be the senior partner in this? Would it have been their initiative, do you think?
I don't think so. You know, people meet up at football conventions all the time, and my understanding is that, you know, this discussion has taken place at a variety of levels. So, you know, Hibs have had a good season in the Scottish Premiership.
They have,
you know, they'll be playing in Europe next season.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not going to say that you know, the English team would be in the bull, you know, in the dominant position here. It's just a case of you know, getting together. You know, we have seen Chelsea have a relationship. Is it Royal Antwerp? So it looks as if clubs are sort of tying up relationships as they go forwards, and it could result in cost savings. It could allow Hibs under-19s to play outside of Scotland, because they can go and play Brighton's under-19s. Mm. Just to see what's working and what's not.
Well, there are a lot of coffee bars and vegan pop-up restaurants in Edinburgh, so it makes sort of sense. It's interview time. David Webb has an impressive career in academy coaching and player recruitment for many clubs, including Spurs, Millwall, Southampton and Crystal Palace, where he was instrumental in discovering and guiding the career of a young Wilfried Zaha. We had a lovely chat with David just earlier today. This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. We are living in an era of information overload, and we have more knowledge than ever before. But what do we do with it all? If you're in Notion, you put that knowledge to work.
It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired. And all I can say on a personal level, as for somebody whose life is quite chaotic, and I'm writing pieces for government and newspapers and media content, I've got my university commitments and I'm supposed to be writing a book, I use Notion all the time because it brings order into chaos.
Well, if you need order brought to your chaos, you can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning your ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
David, thank you so much for joining us. I have to say, if I'd identified Wilf Zaha as a talent at that age and brought him through to a club, I probably would have taken the rest of my career off. You've done enough then, haven't you?
Yeah. He's done fantastically well, hasn't he? So, you know, it's really pleasing to see him and, you know, his family and progressing the way he's doing. So, yeah, he's I think he's done he's had a real, real good career so far, and long may it continue for the Palace.
Yeah, and also it's interesting you mention his family, because most people outside Palace don't realise how tough his upbringing was, and what, you know, the part of Thornton Heath that he was brought up in is you know, there's not a lot of money there, and that boy had to overcome some quite serious difficulties as a kid, didn't he, to become the player that he did.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from when I first see Will play, he played in the same team as my younger cousin. It was a team called White Horse Wanderers, and they played in an area called in West Croydon. And, you know, they're just a newly formed team. They didn't really have a lot of money. They were playing in the C League of the Tandridge, I think. And, they, you know, some weeks I remember the team, because I was at Crystal Palace at the time. I remember my little cousin saying to me, "Oh, you know, we didn't have goals today, or no one had the right kit, or some players couldn't get to training to the games on time because of, you know, someone had to pick them up, he probably lived about three roads away from Wilf, and yeah, it wasn't a great area to be sort of brought up in, but it was a good grounding for him because. You know, it was a tough area. It was, you know, it was quite tough on the family at times, financially and stuff. But, you know, Will persevered, and I think that sort of mentality and that attitude that he had as a very young player, he's taken that all the way forward.
I mean, Wilf is worth a lot of money as a player. Have you ever wondered? Have you ever wondered how much value you've actually brought to clubs in terms of the players you've brought through? Have you ever added up in your head how much some of the players, you know, people like Harry Winks and Dele Alli, when you had that up, you've made a lot of money for clubs, haven't you?
Yeah. Actually, sort of put together something sort of most recently with you know, with the help of someone close to your postcard, and I think it accumulated a sort of added value to clubs over my career of sort of around 205 million, approximately around that.
Wow. That's brilliant. Do you still use the word scout? I was looking at your CV, David, which is very impressive. And I noticed at Southampton you were called the 15-21 talent identification scout. But at Spurs, you were head of elite potential identification. Do you still refer to yourself as a scout, though?
I think scouting is always going to be a big part of whatever role I do because it's something I just love doing. I love discovering new talent. So whether my role as a sporting director or a similar role like that or something to do with recruitment, I would always go and scout players when it comes to sort of making decisions of whether we're going to sign them, because that's a sort of part of the role, you know, I always love doing, is just discovering new talent and see how they can progress and see if they, you know, become successful in the team you're working for. You know, it's a big challenge, but it's also, you know, it's also very exciting.
And you know, you spent time at Palace and at Spurs, as we know. Are there particular problems identifying and recruiting talent in London? So I know Steve Parish, for example, the reason Palace have become a Category 1 club and spent a lot of money on their new training facilities is that he says you can't begin to compete in London unless you're offering those sort of facilities. Is that the case, do you find?
I think especially when I was coaching at Crystal Palace at the time, Arsenal was the main team, and Chelsea sort of in the youth sections overtook them, really, of sort of maybe cleaning up all the local London talent and getting the best players. So even though Crystal Palace are very competitive and it's a great catchment area where they're based and what they can attract, but Chelsea had the resources in terms of scouts and eyes on the ground. They covered all bases of London. You know, they were very, very heavily resourced. And I think when you look at Chelsea and what they was achieving in the youth sections, and then, you know, the players they had there, I think teams like Crystal Palace and Charlton and Millwall and teams like that were finding it hard to get players right on top of their own doorstep to actually sign for a local club when they could, you know, they could go to a Chelsea or an Arsenal or maybe even Fulham to a degree. That I think now having that Category 1 status and also helps as well that Palace have had good success not only with Wilf, with Aaron, and also they've got Tariq Mitchell now. I think if players can see that pathway, especially at a Premiership club, they're more likely to, I think now, more likely to sort of take that route rather than sort of the badge, if you like, where maybe they see the opportunities not to, you know, not so forthcoming. So Palace are on the turn with that, but over the years, yeah, they it would have been sort of really, really hard to compete against you know, the Chelseas and the Arsenals of this world.
Do you approve of Chelsea having so many young players on the books at any one time, so many of whom are never actually going to get to play for Chelsea?
Yeah, they've got an interesting model, Chelsea. You know, they do like to recruit the best talent, and sort of recent times they've had some good sort of players with Loftus-Cheek and Mason Mount and Reece James coming through, and Gilmore as well, who they got from Rangers. Before that, they went for a link spell where not many two players were coming through, but they had the model where their best talent was, they have relationships with clubs in Europe and other Premier League clubs to get them out to try and, you know, to try and accelerate their progress, if you like. So there was arguments for and against that model. Obviously, they're not getting the opportunity maybe at their own club, but they're getting first team football at other clubs. So at a club like Chelsea, where you can financially compete to buy the best players for your first team, you know, opportunities do become really, really hard for the younger talent. So that's why they set up this system where, you know, they could have 20 to 25 players out on loan at various clubs across the UK and mainly Europe, just to see where these players could land. And some have come through that system, players like Christensen, you know, he's playing regularly now for Chelsea. So and some have had to, like Nathan Ake, have had to seek different routes, but have still, you know, Chelsea would still say ugly, but they would produce a centre back for Man City. So I think there's pros and cons for that one.
Yeah. Before we talk specifically about some of the things you've done in your career, you've got a master's in sports psychology. Does that sort of underpin everything you do in football? Do you use that knowledge and experience in just about everything you do as a coach and a recruiter and a scout?
Absolutely, yeah. It's always been sort of a keen subject of mine because, excuse me, when I was sort of in the younger stages of my career, when I was looking to sort of progress onwards, I could see the game probably back in 2008-09 changing to more sports science and becoming a little bit more data-led. And I was always fascinated with psychology and human behaviour and sociology side of things. You know, I wanted to find a way to combine that with football. And, you know, I'd done my coaching badges, my A licence at the time, my academy manager's licence. And there wasn't, at that particular time, I was still finding things that I could look to improve. And when I went to Germany to do my academy manager's licence, by Leverkusen, where you had to do a study visit for sort of 3-4 days to see how the club was run and see the business structures, the academy structures, and how, you know, how a European club was run compared to the English system. So and I never really sort of realised the strength of that, the psychology, how much it was valued in football until I went to Germany, because they actually, as part of my study visit, they got me to do scouting for their sort of an under-16 tournament, and when I did that for them, I didn't have no knowledge of the under-16 players in Germany at all, but I just wrote what I saw based on the day, and then I wrote obviously your normal observations, like the technical, the physical attributes, you know, some little bits of tactical, and then I started to go more in depth about sort of the characteristic side of the game. And it was when I come back after that day of scouting, it was sort of Rudi Völler who said to me, he was the sporting director. He said, "We've never seen this before, where an English scout or coach has gone so much in depth about the character, and they become fascinated with it." So that sort of reinforced my knowledge to really sort of use that as my niche, if you like. So when I come to sort of scouting or profiling players, that, you know, I've got that tool to add to an extra edge, because, you know, for me it's a massive part of the game, which is still probably very much underused.
So does you say it's a massive part of the game, and obviously football is getting more scientific now. Does that mean there's still any room left for sort of instinct or gut feeling, or you just look at a player and you suddenly think, well, never mind the stats, he just looks like he's got it.
Yeah, I think so. I do like the data side of things and the stats side of things, but for me, the data is there as a guide. It's there to sort of produce results on frequencies on the way you play or the way you're looking to recruit. So it's there as a tool, really, and it's, you know, it can be a very powerful tool, but, you know, that's only a small cog when it comes to decision making. The actual seeing the player live over a period of time and getting to know sort of inside and out of his sort of, you know, the background side of him, his social side, what's he like as a character, and how is he going to integrate into the team. You can see certain sort of character things on the pitch, how he plays, that probably data, you know, can't show. So yeah. that's still a key skill, because especially for the managers that I've worked for, that they see the dressing rooms as, you know, quite sacred. And I've heard Guardiola speak about that recently. Yeah. So, you know, it's still a massive part to play, and to get those little extra character bits right. In terms of, you're going to pay sort of quite a lot of money for a player, well, for me, it's invaluable.
And we've talked a lot on the pod. It's something we're both very concerned about, the way young players who don't make it are treated by the club. Is your knowledge of psychology something that helps you talk to young players who might be facing disappointment or despair about losing their career or potentially losing a contract?
Yeah, it does. It helps in a lot of ways for players. It helps with when you're managing staff, and it just gives me a better understanding of, you know, dealing with people, whether that comes to a decision with the players or a management decision or an everyday decision. I think it certainly helps to become more sort of socially equipped, more socially aware. And, you know, really sort of home in on my sort of social and leadership skills in these environments, especially when you're in a role like a sporting director or similar. So, and again, with players, it's with the way the game is now, you know, it's a modern day world. It's a very social media led world. And you have to move, even though you're keeping old fashioned values, which I like to think I do. You still have to adapt to the modern trends of the world and understand sort of the players' world and their language if you want to have, you know, sort of various conversations with them.
You spent time in several countries. Mm. Tell us about your time in Sweden. You were with Östersunds, Graham Potter's old club, who apparently is managing a team that beat Man City this week in a meaningless friendly. I don't know. I'm guessing financially, Sweden wasn't just a different country. It was a different world, wasn't it? Just in terms of the money available.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed that experience because I think it was about maybe sort of 7-8 months or so since I've departed from Tottenham. And it was a chance. You know, I've always been fascinated by European culture and European football. And, yeah. You know, Östersunds had just come off the back of that feel-good season they had with Graham. They'd done fantastically well in Europe. They won the Swedish Cup, and, you know, it was a real romance story what he had achieved at the club, bringing them up from sort of the real lower league. And my experience is when I went there, it was like going back, to basics in a way, because the facilities obviously were very basic. But again, it was a very humble club. The Swedish mentality was that no one is better than no one else. Mm-hmm. The budgets in terms of what you could recruit players for and staff and what I was used to working with, you know, it was like night and day. So it gave me a chance to sort of, you know, rediscover sort of some old values. And I enjoyed the challenge of sort of going back to how I first used to scout, because a lot of it, there wasn't a lot of sort of data information. There wasn't a lot of resource. So again, it was sort of going back to sort of old-fashioned scouting in a way, and doing things that I probably did when I first started my career. And I really enjoyed that, because sometimes it's good when you worked at a club like Tottenham, you've got unlimited resource, unlimited data, unlimited staff. You know, you're seen to compete on the, you know, in various ways, Champions League, league titles. To go back to that, you know, I really enjoyed that experience.
You mentioned earlier what Rudi Völler said to you, and I was interested to hear you say that you're fascinated by European culture. Do you find that the Europeans are surprised still when an English coach turns up to learn from them? Because we still have this sort of reputation of being quite insular, don't we, that we know what's best. So are they surprised when you turn up and you're happy to learn from them?
Yeah, that are to a degree, because historically, if you look, there's not been too many English coaches that have, you know, gone abroad and been successful. You can probably name sort of a handful that have done that, and staff to a degree. So, yeah, from my experience in Germany, it was quite interesting, because they found me, my sort of subject knowledge, because I was just completing my master's at the time of that, quite fascinating. They said, this is very untypically English. And I was like, well, you know, my thinking was, what do you think of an English? And they typically 4-4-2, kick and rush, this side of where at the time Germany were going through this massive transition of this golden generation, where they wanted to win youth tournaments from under 15s all the way through to first team. So they was going through this real transition where back in 2008, 2009, there was probably a lot more advanced than England in terms of their progression. So it was, I suppose I took it as a compliment that they, you know, they see me as forward thinking.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, Germany had one bad World Cup, didn't they? And they just said, right, what went wrong? Let's fix it. And it's something that we've never actually properly done in English football. But I've got a few friends who listen to this pod every week, and they always ask me who the guest is going to be. When I said that you were coming on, two of them said, "Can you ask him this question?" Because and no one seems to know. What's the difference between a sporting director, a director of football, and while we're at it, let's throw in a head of football operations. Are these the same word for the different words for the same role, or are they very different roles?
I think there's slight variations of them. So I think the sporting director's role has evolved from what it used to be. It's a very European structure.
Yeah.
And so the European coaches and again, Germany, were they used to working in this mould. So a sporting director would be to lead the strategic sort of process of the club, and that would be the head coach is there to, rather than a manager, would be there just to coach the first team and help bring success on the pitch and develop players through. So that would be his role. Sporting director would oversee a number of sort of footballing departments, i.e. recruitment, academy transition to first team, medical, sports science, analytics, and would be that bridge between head coach and board level as well, but also driving the process. So if the club had a sort of 3-4 year vision, and your job would be to have a coach in place that buys into the vision of the football club. Yeah. So they wanted to play a certain identity, they wanted to play a certain brand of football, an attacking, transitional, say, for example, type of football. Then you look at your coaches who could execute that for you, for your first team. If that coach moved on during a period of time, i.e. successful, or it didn't work out, then your job is not only to recruit players, but also to recruit the next coach coming in, to have sort of a coach of surveillance, awareness of keeping that wheel turning. So the club keeps to its values, it keeps to its tradition, it keeps to the sort of certain style and the way of playing that, you know, when another coach can come in, that they can automatically just sort of fit into that system, and to keep that sort of long-term planning of the football club going. So it's expanded on that. Some clubs will have like on a different title, say for a technical director, they might have maybe just one or two departments. Some clubs will have maybe 5 or 6 departments. So essentially they cover the same, they'll always cover recruitment, and they'll always cover the head coach, and they'll always cover the long-term structure. But just in terms of leading different departments, that could be under another umbrella. But that would be the main sort of, that'd be the main process that what a sporting director does. So it's the long-term planning of the football club.
Two questions before we go, David. you've worked at Southampton, at Millwall, at Palace, but I think fans of all three of those clubs would accept that the biggest club you've worked at is Spurs.
Yeah.
And while you were at Spurs, you not only did you help integrate Dele Alli and Harry Winks into the first team, you also played a part in identifying Son Heung-min as a transfer target. When you watch Spurs on telly and you see those players wearing a white shirt, that must be an incredibly satisfying feeling, because I mean Son Heung-min, for a start, is probably one of the top three exciting players in the Premier League, and Dele Alli hasn't played a lot of football but for me he should be in the England squad, and Harry Winks as well. I mean, it must be a great feeling of satisfaction to know that you had a part in getting those players into the Premier League and into the first team at Spurs.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always nice when you see, especially younger players like Harry and Dele. And Dele came from Milton Keynes, and his expectations was he wanted to come straight into the first team, where we actually bought Dele, and the initial plan was to, right, okay, come from MK Dons into Tottenham, let's look at his long-term plan, maybe he needs a loan to a championship club. But
yeah,
Dele had such a fantastic attitude and a desire. He wanted to prove himself around the first team. So we spoke with Maurizio and said, we need to give him a good pre-season with yourself and see how he progresses on there before we make any decisions. So, and he proved everyone right, because Maurizio was saying after 2 weeks, he's not going anywhere. He's staying in my first team squad. So, and Harry as well. Because we had such a good relationship with Maurizio and John McDermott, the academy manager. It was good to my role was to help sort of facilitate transition some of the academy players into first team. And Harry Winks was a player at Tottenham we felt that would fit really well into Maurizio's style of play and really take on sort of that deep learning curve as well. That, because Maurizio is an excellent coach and a teacher and an excellent person. So Harry took to that sort of transition really well. And with Song, I was so pleased with him, because when he first came to Tottenham, he sort of struggled a little bit in terms of transitioning to English football, a little bit with the language. And the fans, it took a little bit of time for him to settle in and the fans to get used to him. But what he did have was incredible resilience, incredible work ethic to continue to improve every day in training and continue to sort of learn and integrate himself within, within the areas and the Tottenham team, the environment. And I think some players can, when they get this challenge in front of them, can find it extremely difficult, where some players, like Song, can take the challenge on and really flourish. And yeah, it's very pleasing to see all three of them doing really well.
Yeah. And you know what I particularly like about Dele Alli and Harry Winks as young players, as I've met them both, is they're not big. They're not big, stocky, chunky lads. And for me, that was sort of proof positive that we have a 20-year period in English football where if you weren't physically strong and muscly, you weren't going to make it in the first team. And I think it's so much better now when players with talent are being brought through rather than just big, strong, athletic, box-to-box runners.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a testament to sort of how the game sort of evolved, and maybe sort of some of the influence of sort of foreign coaches that have come in. And Maurizio was, some of his key characteristics was he did like athletic players, but it didn't necessarily mean that they have to be sort of 6'4" and, really built, muscular built and heavy strong. Yeah. So it was more the athleticism in terms of transitioning, sort of the technical and the character. Those were the three bigs for him. He wasn't sort of, depending on position, of course, but he wasn't, he didn't have a preference on size, as long as they sort of had those traits of high quality. That's, that was enough. So it is good to see players come in, and you can see the game changing into that as well, where that's coming back, where you see some sort of leaner profile players like the Phil Fodens and the Dele Allis and the Harry Winks that can play at this level, where, they don't have to be, like you say, so muscularly built.
Yeah, well, even Tyrick at Palace as a left back, which traditionally meant to be a strong physical place, there's nothing of him. But Aaron Wan-Bissaka the same. I've never seen two kids who can tackle better than they can, because it's all about timing rather than about strength. Before we let you go, David, it's been really interesting to talk to you. What's next? Can you tell us what's next for you, what your next job might be, where you're off to? Do you know?
It hasn't been sort of nailed down just yet. I can't really say. Obviously, some of the clubs have been talking to for confidentiality reasons, but there were sort of two clubs in particular, one here, one in Europe. So one based in the UK, one based in Europe. So it's just a case of being for here, just to see when the season might finish and how it finishes for this particular team, and then the one in Europe, sort of an ongoing conversation. So for myself, I hope to be sort of back in by the start, or sort of at least sort of a week or two before pre-season somewhere.
Well, that's brilliant. Whoever you go to, you've obviously got a great deal of talent and enthusiasm and experience to bring to them. So we wish you the very best of luck in your next job.
Thank you very much.
It's lovely to talk to you, David. Thank you very much.
And you. Thank you, Doug.
It's interesting here, isn't it? I asked him the question. It only takes one player to make the first team, and someone like David has earned his wages right there and more, hasn't he?
Yes, yeah. And you know, having a development pathway for players and giving them opportunities saves the club a fortune in terms of A, not having to recruit a player for that particular space, and B, they can monetize it if they so choose to sell. And we have seen other clubs in the Premier League often have 30 or 40 players who are up for sale or a loan at any one point in time, and this becomes an additional revenue stream which helps the club to go out and compete on a first team basis, even if these players themselves never make first team.
Thanks to everyone who's become a patron of the pod via our Patreon site this week, including Mark Silverstein, Simon, Andy Gale, Tom Shelley, David May, Andrew Ross, Colin Wilson and James Wilson. If you'd like to make a small weekly contribution towards our always free to air podcast, then go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you have any questions at all for our next pod, which is Monday's questions one, any questions about the world of football finance, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. And as ever, I shall hand you over to the cock-a-hoop over the moon. Smile as big as an elephant. No, it's not as big as an elephant, so that doesn't make sense. Very cheerful, Kieran Maguire, to say goodbye.
Well, thanks again, folks, for your feedback. If you're enjoying the show, if you can follow on the Apple or the Spotify icon on your phones, and give us a review. You know, just tell us what you think we're doing right, give us wrong, give us 5 stars. It does help produce a guy. We are trying to get as diverse a bunch of guests from different areas of the game as possible, and it just makes us look probably a bit better than we are in reality. But it certainly helps us when we're talking to people in the game.
Thank you.
The Price of Football. The Price of Football.